I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today, the incredible story of a Falmouth man who came to own one of the most famous archaeological sites in the world. Evan J. Albright is the author of The Man Who Owned a Wonder of the World, The Gringo History of Mexico's Chichen Itza. Welcome to the program. Did I say it right?
You said it very well.
Chichen Itza. But that's not really how you say it, though, right?
No, it's Maya. And so in the Maya language, it's Chichen Itza.
Chichen Itza. Okay.
Right.
See if I can remember that. So tell us about Chichen Itza for folks who don't know. And it's a wonder of the world now.
It is a wonder of the world, which is fantastic. The Chichen Itza is located in Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. So if people aren't really familiar with Mexico, what you can do is hold up your right hand with your palm facing you, put your four fingers together and stick out your thumb. Your thumb is the Yucatan Peninsula. Chichen is an ancient Maya city that's located right in the middle of your thumb pad. In its day, it had 250,000 people living there before the Spanish came and conquered Mexico. And then it was abandoned and left to ruin until it was rediscovered in the 19th century.
Yeah. Now, Edward Herbert Thompson was born in Worcester in 1857, and he summered in Falmouth. So tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, he actually did more than summer in Falmouth.
When he was a kid.
He moved to Falmouth and always identified as being a Falmouth guy. Yeah, so he, born and raised in Worcester, went to what is today WPI, Worcester Polytechnic Institute. And then he moved to Falmouth in the 1870s, where he went to work for his father, who owned a brick kiln. Now, local folks here in Falmouth, where this is being broadcast. No, Brick Kiln Road. Yeah. That's the brick kiln. So he went to work for his dad and married a ship captain's daughter. And I guess the brick trade really did not agree with him, because in 1885, he was given an opportunity to be American consul in Merida, Mexico. And at the same time, he would be allowed to explore the ruins of the ancient Maya civilization that was down there.
Yeah. So that was not a hard decision for him. But before we get into that, you came across this story with an old newspaper clipping from 1926 in the Yarmouth Register. So tell us about this. You're going through, because you've written some stories about sort of crime and these unusual snippets that you come across. So that's what you were working on, I'm assuming?
Exactly, right. I had written a series of stories, some of which became a book called Cape Cod Confidential, which was came out about 10, 15 years ago. And then I was working on the sequel to it, and I needed a few more stories to kind of fill out the book. So I went into my file folder, and I pulled out this clipping that I had from 1926. And the story in the Yarmouth Register talked about this gentleman, Edward Herbert Thompson, who was accused by the Mexican government of theft. They charged him with stealing $1 million worth of artifacts from something called the Long Dead City of the Maya, Chichen Itza, which I had never heard of at the time I'm looking at this, and that he had pulled these artifacts from something called the Well of Death. And I said, well, you know, that's an interesting story. Yeah. Let's do that.
It's the Well of Death that pulled you in, wasn't it?
Exactly. But I will also say, and it's I described this in the book, is this was one of those stories that I knew not everything was being told.
Right. There's a lot more to this story.
There was a lot more to this story. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the questions, because I was a reporter for so many years, right? I looked at this story and I go, okay, how exactly do you get $1 million worth of artifacts? This is 1926 money, right? How do you get $1 million worth of artifacts out of Mexico? Because let's just assume it was pure gold.
Yeah.
That would be a ton of gold. So how would you smuggle these things out of there? How would you dig them up and take them out? The other thing is, he did this in between 1904 and 1910, yet they didn't charge him until 1926.
Yeah.
How was this kept secret for 15 years? How would you keep something like that secret? And here's kind of the biggest part, was he shipped those artifacts to the Peabody Museum at Harvard University, which was studying them and didn't seem to be keeping them secret. So anyway. It didn't make any sense. So I knew that if I started to dig into it, it would take me in places that maybe I would be spending some time, a long time, doing some research. And indeed, this took me 10 years to write this book.
And I'll tell you, when I started reading the book, I thought, okay, it's going to be about this. There's so much more. There's so many twists and turns here. And so many, like, what? You come around the corner and there's another story that you didn't expect. So let's go back a little bit. Tell us about this paper that he wrote, Atlantis Not a Myth, because this sort of ties into how he got this job.
Right. So in the 1800s, there was a real popular belief that was growing among even academics that the ancient city of Atlantis was real, and that the story of Atlantis, which Plato had written about, I'm sure most people are familiar with it, was this amazing civilization that was destroyed in a cataclysm 10,000 years ago. It's a myth, and we don't know if it's true or not, but there were a lot of people who believed it was true. And in the 1900s, Edward Herbert Thompson theorized that if the Maya civilization, or if the Atlantis actually did exist, the remnants of it could be found in the Maya civilization in Mexico. He wrote an article on it, and it was published in Popular Science, which is still the Popular Science that is published today. It's the earlier version of it. And this article came to the attention of some very, very wealthy men and powerful men in the city of Worcester.
And we should say the Mayan civilization was pretty amazing. I mean, talk a little bit about who the Mayan people were.
Right. So, I think people are familiar with the term Maya civilization. Mm-hmm. So there were the Mayas, the Aztecs, the Incas. You know, these are all pre-Columbian civilizations that existed in the Americas. The Mayas existed basically from Mexico to El Salvador, and they built amazing cities. I mean, beautiful cities. Chichen Itza is one of the later ones. That one actually appeared around 900, 1000 AD. Many of them go back to the to the time of Christ. Palenque, Tikal, these are all amazing places, cities of thousands and thousands of people, a civilization that had armies and wars and raised food and kept an elite. Incredible civilization that existed in the Americas that today we kind of take for granted. But the reality is that during the Dark Ages, you know, when, you know, people were struggling to live in Europe, it was thriving here in the Americas.
Yeah. And people may remember the Mayan calendar coming. It was coming to an end. It was like, is the world going to end? What's going to happen when that Mayan calendar comes to an end?
Right. It's a digression from the story. But I did originally, that was going to be in the book, was 2012. And I'll just summarize what I found in a sentence, which is in 2012, the world was supposed to end. That was the big theory. And so I actually realized that nobody was asking the Maya themselves, who still live in the same area. Nobody had asked them what's going to happen. So I actually did speak to some Maya shaman, which are called Himin, down there, and I had a great conversation with them. And at the end of the conversation, I found out the world's going to end.
It didn't.
Thank heavens.
So there has been so much written about the Mayans. Talk about how you wade through that with your research, because, I mean, you could just read things for 10 years and everything that's been written about them.
Right. And it feels like that's what I did. One of the things that I did when I started this project was I said, I am going to stay focused on Chichen. That's it. I am not going to go into Uxmal, Palenque, Tikal, the other civilizations, parts of the civilization of the other ages. I'm just going to focus on Chichen. And then I even centered my investigations even tighter into the people who, the archaeologists who explored Chichen and its history. So I tried to stay away as much as I possibly could from becoming an expert on the Maya civilization, because first of all, there's people a lot smarter than me who could do that. And the other thing is, it is a huge, huge subject.
It sure is. All right. So one of the things that happened to you early on is you started an email conversation with the gentleman who owned when the book, he still owned Chichen Itza, but now it's the Mexican government has taken it back. But we'll talk about that after. But tell us about this. You come up, Fernando.
Right. Don Fernando. So and I laugh because he became such a wonderful, wonderful friend. But I was interviewing an archaeologist down there who told me, hey, I was just down in Yucatan, and they were all upset because some gentleman was claiming that he owned Chichen Itza. And I thought, well, that can't be possible because it's this amazing city that tourists go to all the time, and it's run by the government. So I did a little research and found out that there was a gentleman by the name of Fernando Barbachano Gomez Rule who was claiming to own Chichen. But I couldn't find any quotes by him in any of the media. So I said, you know what, let me just ask him because that's what I do. And so I found his email address and I sent him an email. And he replied back to me almost instantly. He called me EJ, because that's what my email address is. And he says, EJ, yes, I would love to talk to you about Chichen and owning Chichen. When are you coming to Yucatan? And I go, I had no plans of going to Yucatan at that time. But something changed in my research that made me decide that I had to go down there. And we can talk about that if that's something that you would like, because it was a life-changing event for me.
Yes, and we'll get to that in a second. But tell us, how did he claims his father?
So Edward Thompson had purchased Chichen Itza in 1894, which is in itself an amazing story, and I trace it in the book. So Thompson had purchased it, and then when he died in 1935, it went to his heirs, and in 1944, there was a case in the Mexican Supreme Court to decide the ownership of Chichen, and that case came out in Thompson's favor. Of course, he was long dead by then. The one who financed the case, as in paid for the lawyers to defend that case, was Fernando Barbachano Peon, who was the father of the man I became friends with, and part of the deal was, if he won the case, the Thompson family would agree to sell him Chichen Itza. And indeed, that's what they did. And he built probably one of the biggest tourism empires in the Americas, and certainly is the father of tourism in Yucatan today. The reason there's a Cancun, the reason there's a Playa del Carmen, the reason there's a Tulum can be traced directly back to Fernando Barbachano Peon.
Wow. All right. So talk about this relationship between Thompson and Stephen Salisbury, because this is how he gets this job as the American consul.
Right. So Stephen Salisbury was one of the richest men in the country at the time in the 1880s. Salisbury was based out of Worcester. Now, Worcester was a really interesting place because it had gone from kind of a farming community to becoming the transportation hub for all of Massachusetts. And that power that was there made several men very, very rich, among them Stephen Salisbury, whose family goes back there. And if you go to Worcester today, you'll see Salisbury Street and the Salisbury Mansion. So Stephen Salisbury belonged to an organization called the American Antiquarian Society, which is still there today. And he had gone to Mexico in the around the Civil War. Well, to be honest, he had paid to get out of the Civil War and then went to Mexico while hostilities were going on here. And he always had this interest in the Maya civilization. So what he wanted to do was to pay somebody to go down to Mexico to take care of that on his behalf. But I don't think he wanted to use his own money, hence why he got Thompson the job as American consul. And it was really a unique situation that we had where Thompson was down there as a representative of the U.S. government, but at the same time, he was exploring Maya ruins on behalf of some rich men from Worcester, Massachusetts.
That's amazing. All right, so the secret that sent you to the Yucatan, you interview some of Thompson's family members, and you find out there may be some relatives in Mexico.
That's right. So one of the things that I like to do is I'm a contrarian by nature, and so I don't take anything at face value. And I already told you that I had problems with this 1926 story. But the other thing was I asked myself, gee, I wonder if any of Thompson's relatives are still alive. And if so, do they know anything about him? So I first thing I did was I went to the phone book, and that tells you how long ago this was because there was a phone book. And I just looked up the name Edward Thompson. Turned out there was an Edward Thompson. And
in
Falmouth. And it turns out it was his grandson. So from there, that led me to a whole bunch of Thompson relatives, and I just went from one to the next one. One of them that I interviewed was Helene Thayer, who was a great-granddaughter of Edward Thompson, and she was staying at the last piece of property the family still owned in Falmouth, which was this beautiful, beautiful piece of property on Black Beach, and people who are from here are very familiar with it.
It's a beautiful beach.
Beautiful, beautiful. And so I interviewed her there, and she was a little nervous. Because, you know, I called her out of the blue to talk about this subject. And so she was very hyper. And so I turn on my recorder, and the first thing she tells me is, oh, did you know that Papa Grande, and that's what the family called him, Papa Grande, did you know that Papa Grande had a Maya wife, and they had children? And I had to confess, I did not know that.
Here's one of those twists and turns I was talking about.
And at that moment, I knew I had to go to Yucatan and find that family. I knew they still had to be there. And it turns out there had been no contact between the American Thompsons and the Mexican Thompsons. And you know what? By gosh, I was going to go down there. I was going to find them, and I was going to bring the two families together.
Yeah. And what's interesting is the American Thompsons wanted to know that. They were interested in what you would find.
It was incredible to me. But the American Thompsons, God bless them, are an incredible group of people. I found them just a delight. And they were not shocked at all. Now, that's not true for all Thompson descendants, as I found out later. But for the group that I knew, they wanted to know the answer.
They wanted to know the answers. We're talking with Evan J. Albright. His book is The Man Who Owned a Wonder of the World, The Gringo History of Mexico's Chichen Itza. We're going to find out what happened in Mexico after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Evan J. Albright, author of The Man Who Owned a Wonder of the World. So you decide to go to Mexico and find these relatives. I have to say, there was a great quote you have in the book from Thompson. Some things need to be examined with a telescope, some with a microscope, Mexico with a kaleidoscope. So you actually do find these relatives that you were looking for in Mexico.
It was incredible. It was a life-changing experience. Because it's hard for me to put in words how, which I did in the book, incidentally, but it's hard for me to put into words what this trip meant. Because just to take you back a second, my wife and I would discuss like where we wanted to go on vacation. And the one place we completely agreed on was we would never go to Mexico. And next thing you know, I'm taking my entire family down to Mexico on a research trip. And all they know is I'm going down there to find this family. But they don't know how I'm going to do it. And I don't even know if I'm going to be able to do it. And this was the first time that I had ever planned a vacation. So needless to say, my wife was very nervous about this. But she was a terrific sport, as was my children. Well, what my children and my wife got to see was what I do, which is report and investigate and find people and talk to people. And I wish I could say it was because I was a genius that I found them. But what I did was I went to Chichen and I stayed at the Hacienda Chichen, which is formerly had been owned by Edward Thompson. It's now a beautiful resort. I recommend it for anybody down there.
And this is Fernando who owns it.
It's the Barbachano family that owns it. Yes, Fernando owned it. It went to his sister, and now it's actually his sister still owns it because Fernando has since passed away. So we're at this beautiful resort, and I just start asking around. And it turns out, I find out that Thompson had a son by the name of Carlos Marufo, and that son was no longer with us, but his wife is still living in Piste, which is a little village next to Chichen Itza. So I go, huh, well, I guess I have to find her. I wonder how I'll do that. And then that night, we were having dinner, and there were what's called trova musicians. Trova is a style of music that came out of Cuba. It's three ballad singers. They play guitars, and they sing these delightful ballads, usually that'll bring a tear to your eye because they're so lovely. So there were three Maya men who were playing trova. And, you know, at that time, I was actually working on just recording everything because I was going to do something for CAI, which we had talked about off air. So I said, hey, would you gentlemen be willing to, be part of this documentary? And they were thrilled. And so they were performing. And so at the end, I said, well, what are your names? And they go, blah, 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 blah. And this last one says, Joel Marufo. And I went, excuse me, wait, is your name Marufo? And he said, yes. And I said, are you related to Doña Maria Luisa, who is the wife of Carlos Marufo? Yes, that is my grandmother. And I go, holy net. And so I'm going, here we are. And so I said, well, I really want to interview Maria Luisa, and I want to know this family. And what do you know?
Yeah.
They put me in touch with the family and told me the story of Edward Thompson.
Yeah. Sorry, and the book does kind of go past and present, so I'm going to jump back in the past again. Let's talk about the biographer T.A. Willard. He wrote The City of the Sacred Well in 1926, and Thompson says he exaggerated his story, but that had a big impact on Thompson.
It did. So
this is where you're saying, how did that go unnoticed? Not after 1926.
How did that go unnoticed in 1926? Well, so what happened was Thompson. Well, it was interesting because this is a time in archaeology when there were big discoveries being made. Schliemann had discovered the ancient city of Troy, and King Tut's tomb had just been discovered. So I think maybe Thompson wanted to be a part of that. Hard to say. But in any case, he agreed to be interviewed by this gentleman, T.A. Willard, who offered to write a biography of Thompson and write about the discoveries of what was found in the well. And once that book was published, the Mexican government got a hold of it, and that's when all hell broke loose.
Right.
And they went after Thompson hardcore. They seized Chichen Itza. They charged him with theft. Thompson at the time was out of the country because he lived in Falmouth, and he would regularly commute back and forth between Yucatan and his home in Falmouth. And he was never able to return to Mexico after that while this was all being litigated.
So let's talk about that well. It's a sacred well. It was a cenote, is that?
Yeah. It's these are giant sinkholes and they're peppered throughout Yucatan. And so, yes, they're called cenotes. We call them sinkholes here, but there's usually, it's cave-ins where there's water in the bottom. And mind you, in Yucatan, there is no water. It is a desert for all intents and purposes. While there is a luscious growth everywhere you see, this is all not water that's pulled out of the ground. This is water that's pulled out of the air. That's how all these plants and animals survive.
You find one of those cenotes and you see all these beautiful orchids and things that are right there. Yeah, they're
spectacular,
very beautiful,
gorgeous.
Yeah.
Now, the one that's not beautiful
is this one.
Is the sacred well. It is one of the most godforsaken. You understand why the Maya held this particular place in awe. The water down below is this green, luminescent, stagnant water. It looks stagnant water. And so what the Maya did back in the old days is they would perform sacrifices at the sacred well. And so one of the things that they would do is they would throw, if they had gold, that would be thrown in there. Jade, carved jade, pots. And they also threw people.
People, right.
Right. And the goal was to do sacrifices so that you would appease the rain god and bring rains. Mm.
And the interesting, the ball court, which when they have the games, and it would be, was the winner or the loser the one that was sacrificed? And it was the winner?
Well, it turns out it's whatever guide you happen to
talk to.
Right. It was, I've heard rational explanations for why the winner was sacrificed. I've heard rational explanations for, well, obviously why the loser would be sacrificed. They have the biggest ball court in the world. Is in Chichen. And this is a game that they would play where you couldn't, it was like soccer in that you couldn't touch the ball with your hands. Mm-hmm. But the idea, at least some theory, some people theorize, was that there are these little rings up in the wall. And what you would do is try with your hip, hit a ball, a hard rubber ball up through this ring. And I got to tell you, me personally, the game had to be something different because it looks
so impossible.
It would have gone days, right?
So this sacred well is very difficult to explore. So Thompson has choices of draining, dredging, or diving.
Correct.
So what does he do?
Well, what he eventually decided to do was to dredge. And so he imported a giant dredge from New England, from Boston, had it shipped down, had it carried overland. It weighed tons, had it carried overland by hand to Chichen, where he set it up next to the sacred well. And then over the course of several years, he dredged and dredged and dredged. Now, mind you, nobody knew for sure if the legends of gold and jade and human sacrifice were true. That was just what was spoken of. It was a myth. But what Thompson did was he actually proved that indeed that was true, that those objects were sacrificed into the cenote sagrado, as it's called. But then the dredge started coming up dry, and it would start not bring up any more artifacts. And so Thompson realized probably the only way that I'm going to be able to get any more material out of here is if I go down by hand. Now, mind you, this is in 1904, 1910. Mm-hmm. This is before scuba gear. This is before any of that. And so what Thompson had to do was get one of those old-fashioned, you know, diving helmets and diving suits and go down. He hired a diver. The diver went in, and then the diver came out and said, no, I can't do this. This is way too dangerous. And so Thompson, at 50-plus years old, dove himself and dove on several occasions.
Yeah.
It was very dangerous. He didn't do it for that long, but he did actually find some amazing artifacts.
Yeah, and the artifacts, you know, his critics charged him with stealing artifacts, but in fact, you didn't find that. You found that the really important artifacts he did send to the Peabody Museum.
Well, there's a whole ethical question here, right? So what happened was, yes, indeed, he did, smuggle is the word, mm-hmm. them out of Mexico to the Peabody Museum.
But it was not illegal.
That's the key.
Yeah.
So this is really interesting because the people of Mexico, archaeologists in Mexico in particular, are very, very upset at Thompson. I mean, even after all these years, William Fash, who is the director of the Peabody Museum, he was recently, and by recently, I mean in the last 10 years, he went down to Mexico. And right away, he was besieged by reporters who were going, when are you going to give these artifacts back? When are you going?
Right.
And I felt bad for the poor guy. But here's the thing. And this is a major denouement from my book, because I did the research and I looked at the case law. Thompson's case went all the way up to the Supreme Court of Mexico. Now, this is the Mexican version of the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. the highest court in the land, and it was fully adjudicated, and it was adjudicated aggressively by the government of Mexico against Thompson. And in the end, they lost.
Yeah, amazing.
They had no case.
Yeah.
And so it turns out that the Peabody Museum, the only thing that it was found guilty of, and not the Peabody, but Thompson, was exporting the artifacts without permission. And that was a 500 peso fine. Now, it's not in the book, but I did talk to Don Fernando Barbachano Gomez Rule. And what he claimed was that because his father had financed the case in Mexico, what he claimed was that his father paid that fine mm-hmm. of 500. So the Peabody Museum owns those artifacts free and clear. Now, a lot of people argue with that, mm-hmm. but you know what? The highest court in the land said so.
Yeah, that's amazing. And this lawsuit dragged on for a long time.
Oh, yeah. It wasn't resolved until long after Thompson's death. And that is not unusual in Mexico. Mm-hmm. One of the things that most people know down there is never bring a lawsuit because it will take years and a lot of money to resolve.
So Thompson did discover tools and building materials that helped to explain how the Maya had constructed their pyramids without the use of metal tools. I mean, he had some really important discoveries.
Right. A lot of people have said that Thompson was not an archaeologist, that he was an antiquarian. That's the word that they use for it, which is basically somebody who goes down and collects material to ship back to museums. This was a big thing that was done in the 19th century. But the reality was he actually did make some significant discoveries. Now, beyond proving that the Cenote Sagrado had been used for sacrifice, he also came up with a nice little bit of theory that showed how the major structures were built using the same principles that are used to build the huts that you will see down in Yucatan.
Yeah. And talk a little bit, he was doing this archaeological work, but he also had this plantation.
Exactly. Yeah. So Edward Thompson, he had purchased the Hacienda Chichen, which included the ruins of Chichen Itza. Now, I have to be careful here because he did not own the ruins themselves, as in the buildings, but he owned all the land around them. And what's true in Mexico is that there may be a handful of ruins where the property is owned by the Mexican government. All the rest are in private hands. And the tragedy of Mexico is that a lot of these places, if a landowner finds ruins on his property, first thing he will do is destroy them because that prevents him from fully exploiting his land as much as he can. In Thompson's case, he bought all the land around Chichen, and he began a series of business ventures. And it's described in the book. He was not a very good businessman. So he had one catastrophe after another. The one thing that he was ahead of his time on, and I give him 100% credit, was in tourism. He knew that this area would be big for tourism. And while Fernando Barbachano Peon gets credit for building tourism in Yucatan, it was on the shoulders of what Edward Thompson had planned almost from the very beginning. In fact, Barbicano basically followed Thompson's plan but Thompson himself never was able to make it real.
Yeah, let's talk about that meeting you had with the relatives of Thompson's in Mexico. You went that first time with the grandson who translated for you. They wanted you to come back with the whole family. They were like, you think you're done, but they're like, no, you, and very insistent that you come back with the family.
This is the transformation of the book, and this is why the book is written the way it is. So the book is written in two parts. One is the history, and the other is a memoir. And for me, I never would have written it in a memoir part, except for that became an incredible part as far as the story, as far as my own personal growth. So I was there, I interviewed the family, and, you know, having been a newspaper reporter for years, you know, there's a certain distance that you keep from your subjects because you're there to report on them, and they understand that, right? For example, the conversation you and I are having right here, we're not going to go out and have drinks afterwards, and you're not going to ask me to come visit your family, right? So, but I was down there, and when I finished the interview, I'm walking out, and Bibiano Utun, who is the son-in-law, and really was the one who did the translating, he says, where is your family? Now, he had met my family the night before because he was one of the Trova singers, and I said, well, no, they're back at the resort. You know, they're hanging out. I'm here. This is my business. And he was like, no, you must bring your family. They want to meet your family. My family wants to meet your family. And it never occurred to me. And so it was then that I kind of learned that important lesson that when it comes to Mexico, it's all about family.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, too, because when you do bring your family, the guy who speaks English isn't there.
Right, exactly. So we have the Thompson descendants who do not speak English or barely speak English, and we have my family who speaks very little Spanish. And incidentally, this is a part of the book, is that the fact that I don't speak Spanish. I read it okay, but I don't speak it at all. And this is a country that is almost all the language that's spoken is either Spanish or Maya. Mm-hmm. So we have these two families come together, and you would have thought this would have been a train wreck. But it turned out to be, if you ask my kids, it was the best part of the trip. Mm-hmm. There was an exchange that occurred. And while we couldn't really capture it in language, it was one family meeting another family. And I've been friends with this family ever since.
Yeah, I would say, and your kids were happy they took Spanish in school, right?
Yeah.
they were the ones that were
What little they knew, that was what got us through.
And, and also, you walked away from that meeting with, again, an important piece of information or photos, the photos that you
right.
got at
the Right, end. So I had photos of Carlos Marufo, who was the son of Edward Thompson. And I took those photos back up to the Mexican cousins, to the American Thompsons, and was able to present it to them, yeah.
And how trusting. This woman doesn't speak English. You don't speak Spanish. You're taking these photos, and you're telling her, I'll get them back to you. I'll get you copies. She probably has no idea what you're saying, but she trusts you to do that.
Absolutely true. This is, again, these are amazing people. They don't have a lot. You know, this is not a wealthy area. They are scrabbling to make a living, quite frankly, the family are farmers. You know, they are raising maíz, right, in the traditional way, in the traditional mm-hmm. Maya way. And so these photographs are the last that they have of her father, in this mm-hmm. case. This was Victoria and her father, Carlos Marufo, the son of Edward Thompson. And perfectly fine. And you guess what? I came back.
And you gave him back. We're talking with Evan J. Albright. His book is The Man Who Owned a Wonder of the World, The Gringo History of Mexico's Chichen Itza. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Evan J. Albright, The Man Who Owned a Wonder of the World, The Gringo History of Mexico's Chichen Itza. Let's talk a little bit about your coming back and informing the American Thompsons about the Mexican Thompsons. There's a little bit of information that you're hesitant to tell, but you have to tell them how he leaves the Mayan wife with nothing, and she gets evicted, and it's a bad story.
Right. So when I interviewed the Thompson descendants in Mexico, I asked, I had told them, I said that the family in the United States is very concerned that their grandfather, Edward Thompson, left the Mexican family with nothing. Because he had to leave, you'll recall, because he was charged with theft. And so I was very worried. His daughter, Victoria, or his son, Edward, Carlos Marufo, and the woman that he had Carlos with, which was Doña Victoria, ended up getting left with absolutely nothing. And what had happened was when Thompson left, Victoria had a little place that was next to the Hacienda Chichen, and she would rent out rooms to travelers. And when the I found out that what happened was when the Supreme Court case was resolved, that when Barbachano, who now owned the property, Doña Victoria thought that she also owned her property, and so she wanted to build a hotel there. And since Barbachano owned it and it would be competing with him, he told her, no, you can live here for the rest of your life, but you cannot build a hotel here. And it went to a court case and she lost and she was evicted. Mm. So in the end, because Thompson did not leave her with a legal title to the property. So when I told the family, they were not happy, but they accepted it. And not only that, they also said, you know what? Let's go to Yucatan and let's meet the family.
We're not going to give away everything in the book, so don't worry. But I want to talk about what's there on the site now. Edward Herbert Thompson, made big discoveries, but there's the dredge and a little plaque.
Right, right. There's nothing about Edward Thompson other than this nasty plaque that talks about him stealing the artifacts. And thank heavens, most of the plaque is in Spanish. So
most people don't know what it says.
Most people don't know. But the dredge itself is set up right outside the bathrooms. So when you...
In a prime spot. I guess everybody's going to see it, maybe. I don't know.
Right. Well, I'm going to tell you that pretty well describes what the Mexicans think of Edward Thompson, to say the least. Yeah.
Well, he had two rivals that you talk about in the book. First, let's hear about Alfred Maudslay. Is that how you say his name?
Yeah, Alfred Maudslay. Maudslay wasn't a rival, but Maudslay was a very wealthy man who probably was the first real archaeologist in the Maya area. And this was around the turn of the previous century. Maudslay was an amazing guy, but there was a little bit of jealousy between him and Edward Thompson. Not on Maudslay's part. Maudslay was fine. But Edward Thompson was a little jealous of all the resources and everything else that Maudslay had to be able to explore these ancient cities. So it was kind of funny because what Edward Thompson did was, this is before he purchased Chichen, was he visited Maudslay. And then on his way back, he wrote a letter to his sponsors, Stephen Salisbury, and said, Maudslay's in Chichen, but Chichen is not worth exploring because Chichen has been overrun by, and according to Edward Thompson, and by the way, this is very prescient, is it's been overrun by tourists. Mm. And so because there's trash everywhere and people come from all over to see these ruins. Well, Maudslay ended up producing an amazing piece of work, which, if you can go online and you can find it, it's an incredibly detailed exploration of Chichen and probably the most first scientific one. The other rival, however, was...
I was going to say, this guy didn't like him at all.
This guy hated Thompson, but also hated Maudslay, hated everybody.
Everybody. So tell us about him.
Theobert Mahler, who was he was Austrian. And he hated Thompson and spent his life basically making Thompson's life a living hell in Yucatan. So Thompson went to Uxmal, which is another beautiful ruin there. I recommend people go see. It's absolutely lovely. But when Thompson went there, Mahler went there afterwards and claimed that Thompson had been stealing artifacts and that he had destroyed the ruins. And that he was a fake archaeologist. And he would write, Mahler would write these letters to the local newspaper. This is the part that's really interesting about this, is we talk about how T.A. Willard exposed Thompson in 1926. But the fact is, Mahler had been writing to the newspapers from the beginning when Thompson was dredging the Cenote Sagrado. It was not a secret. This is also a key part that I probably helped Thompson win his court case, is the Mexican government knew what Thompson was doing at Chichen Itza. They knew, but they didn't stop him. They turned a blind eye. Why? Because this was going to be good for Mexico. These were the days when Americans were basically sold property and sold companies. American investment was encouraged in Mexico. With every fiber of my being, I believe that the Mexican government, I know for a fact, they knew what was going on. And so in the end, Mahler tried to stop him, and couldn't do it because Thompson had the approbation of the Mexican government.
Yeah. You were asked the question, was Edward Thompson a good man? Tell us what you were thinking when that at that time. How did you answer that?
Yeah. I'm trying to do it without spoiling the book.
Yeah.
I did have concerns. So after doing all this research and to find out that Carlos Marufo and his mother, Doña Victoria, had been abandoned, it really seemed to me like Edward Thompson had, he was not a good man. He had not made the right decisions. And so at one point, Bibiano, who's the son-in-law, had asked me that question, was Edward Thompson a good man? And I told him, I said, I thought he was. But you know what? In my heart, I thought that maybe he wasn't. But then I got a piece of news, which is at the very last chapter of the book. I got a piece of news.
That changed your mind.
It totally changed my mind. Now, one of the things, without giving it away, mm-hmm. but I had read hundreds of letters written by Edward Thompson, and there was nothing more important to him than family. And he loved the Maya. So this was not one of these things where he was an overlord and, no, he loved the Maya. And that he would have children by a Maya woman and not love them, to me, would have been absolutely shocking. And as I found out,
that was the case.
It turns out that was the case.
Let's talk about the critics and people who say, oh, he stole all these artifacts and he made riches. You didn't see any riches, and his family didn't see any riches.
No.
So that didn't appear to be true.
No, absolutely not true. He did not make, I mean, speaking of how important family was to him, his explorations were all done to support his family, and he did not make any large chunks of money. Now, he had grand schemes at Chichen, to raise papaya, right, or to raise henequen, which is what they used to make rope down there. But the reality was he did what he did to keep his family alive, keep them comfortable, and have something to pass on to his children. That's the only reason that he did it. You won't find that he made any sizable amount of money from any of the explorations that he did. And I think that's significant because those artifacts, the bulk of them,
worth a lot of money.
Minor part of the book is I actually do find some of the artifacts on sale on eBay.
And
they were not cheap,
just
to say the least. And these were not amazing artifacts like are in the museums. Now, to the Peabody Museum's credit, before anybody starts harping on the Peabody, the Peabody Museum did give back half the gold and half the jades and returned them to, gave them as a gift to Mexico in exchange for other artifacts. But as William Fash told me at the Peabody, he says, you know, museums are not in the business of giving stuff away. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting is that there is a book being prepared, which may come out pretty soon. I'll be right there to read it, which is going to make the case on the opposite side that the Peabody Museum should return the artifacts. Mm-hmm. And I'll be very interested to read that.
Yeah. So who owns Chichen Itza now?
So when I began this project, it was owned by the Barbachano family. And literally maybe a few days right before I reached out to Don Fernando Barbachano Gomez Rule, he had given it to his grandson, Hans Ties Barbachano. And so that's who owned it during the period that's described in this book. But then the Mexican government threatened to take it. And as Don Fernando had told me, they're welcome to try, but they're going to pay me a pretty price. And it turned out they had no legal foot to stand on to take Chichen via legal means, you know, by eminent domain, which is what they attempted to do. So as described in the book, what happens is the state of Yucatan was, you know, watching this on the sidelines, waiting for the federal government to take over. It failed miserably. So the state of Yucatan negotiated and bought the property outright from Hans Ties. Now, what they bought, incidentally, is just the center part, the part where all the tourists go.
Right.
So when you go to Chichen and you see the massive pyramid of Kukulcan, which is there in the center, or the ball court that we described, or the Cenote Sagrado, those are all things that are now property that is now owned by the state of Yucatan. Recently, I think 2-3 years ago, the federal government purchased what's called Chichen Viejo Old Chichen, which is another part which is closed to tourists but has some amazing ruins on it. At some point, it will be opened. So the federal government now owns that. The Barbachano family still owns a lot of other ruins,
yeah.
And as well as their hotels and other tourist stuff that are in the area.
Mm. So, and we don't need to go into this too much right now, but there was also, in the 1960s, there was another exploration of the well. So they're still discovering things.
Right, yeah. So in the 1960s, there were two expeditions into the Cenote Sagrado, and these were with the open permission of the Mexican government, in which we had a group of Americans working with Mexicans and they actually dived the Cenote Sagrado using aqualungs, which now, of course, you know, it's easier to do than it was then. And they recovered a lot of artifacts. But I interviewed the gentleman who kind of was the man behind both of these expeditions. And one of the things that he told me, there's a scene where he kind of, in a book describing this, where he walks by Thompson's dredge, and what he thinks about is that Thompson, with his dredge, the whole thing probably cost $20,000 to do all that Thompson did. This was in the millions, whatever it was, to do this later one. That for that little amount of money, Thompson found a million times more artifacts than what these later expeditions found. Yeah.
Now, you actually got to climb up the pyramid, which you can no longer do. So tell us what that experience was like and what the view is like.
Well, so the it looks easy to climb up it.
Yeah, it's not.
right, because we were describing.
Yeah, I climbed Coba, but not Chichen Itza.
So the and it's no different.
Yeah.
First of all, it looks very uniform. The steps are not. One of the things is that the risers are higher than they are deep, right? So I have very big feet. I have size 13 clodhoppers, right? So you can imagine I could only get the front pad of my foot onto these steps as I'm climbing up. And, if you look down, it looks really steep and really scary. So you can imagine that probably only elites were allowed to climb the pyramids back in the day. But the view from the top was breathtaking, to say the least. Mm-hmm. You could see in all directions. Yucatan is flat. I mean, it's a limestone shelf. Mm-hmm. That's all it is. And you can see everywhere. You know, you can almost see to the ocean, it seems like, from Chichen. And but unfortunately, now you're no longer allowed to climb.
And while we're mentioning, we should mention Tulum. That is the only ruins that you find right on the ocean. It's beautiful. You can't climb that as well. But Coba, you can still climb.
Except, actually, you can climb Tulum.
Tulum?
Yes. Ask Justin Bieber, who was just kicked out of Tulum because he had been partying and insisted on climbing the ruins.
But you're not supposed to climb
them.
No, it's closed to climbing.
It is.
So just in the last minute or so that we have, as you're uncovering this research, this book really turned into something you weren't expecting. You were kind of looking at this history stuff and you found this whole other story.
Right. So to me, the book is two books, but they all kind of come together at the end. And, you know, there is the history in there. And I think the history
is fascinating.
Most people will find very interesting. Because even if you know nothing about the Maya, nothing about Chichen Itza, or you just visited it on a trip from Cancun, that history is interesting. And it's interesting that it was owned by an American and the whole history behind that. But the other part of it is indeed the memoir part, which kind of talks about where Chichen is today. And also kind of that part of Mexico that we don't really get to see, which is, again, the importance of family, the importance of how close everybody is, and how these things have gone on for generations and generations there. It's actually an amazing place. And I got to tell you, despite what the nasty stuff we hear about Mexico, this area is relatively crime-free. It's very safe to visit. I recommend it for anybody. There's no violence there. Go down and see Chichen yourself.
All right. Evan J. Albright, the man who owned a wonder of the world, the gringo history of Mexico's Chichen Itza. Thanks for being here. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.